Mystery Club. Chapter 101. Do you like Pilates? Asks Ibrahim.
I couldn't tell you, says Gordon Playfair.
What is it?
His tour of Cooper's Chase finished, Gordon Playfair is sitting with Ibrahim, Elizabeth, and Joyce, on Ibrahim's balcony. Ibrahim has a brandy, Elizabeth has a G&T and Gordon has a beer. Ibrahim has them in the fridge for Ron, although Ron seems to be drinking wine these days. Chris and Donna have returned to Fairhaven. Before they left, Chris had told them a little about Cyprus and about Gianni's connections. He was pretty sure they have identified their man. Donna was clearly still angry at them, but she would get over it. The sun is setting and the day is winding down. Matthew Mackey has gone home to Bexhill, and to the two candles he keeps lit at all times. Joyce has promised to come down and visit him. She loves Bexhill. It is the art of controlled movement, says Ibrahim. Says Gordon Playfair, considering this. Is there darts?
There is snooker, says Ibrahim.
Gordon nods.
That's near enough.
They look out over Cooper's Chase. In the foreground is Larkin Court, curtained windows in Elizabeth's flat. Beyond that is Ruskin Court, willows, and the convent. Then those beautiful hills, rolling to the horizon.
I could get used to this, says Gordon.
There seems to be a lot of drinking involved.
Always, agrees Ibrahim.
The phone rings and Ibrahim gets up to answer it. He talks to Gordon Playfair over his shoulder as he goes.
I think I've made Pilates sound too boring.
It is very good for the core muscles and for flexibility. At any rate, it is every Tuesday. Gordon watches some of the residents pass by below and sips his beer.
You know, I'm not kidding, but I wouldn't know if any of these women had been here back then.
Who's to say?
All those nuns.
I wouldn't know, you know.
You could have been one of the nuns, Joyce.
Joyce laughs.
It feels like I have been for the last couple of years.
Not for the want of trying.
Elizabeth has been thinking the same as Gordon Playfair.
The nuns.
Perhaps that was the route they would have to go down next?
It was Thursday Murder Club tomorrow.
Maybe that's where they should start.
She feels the gin beginning to work its magic.
Ibrahim returns from his call.
That was Ron.
He would like us to join him for a drink.
It seems Jason has gifts for us all. Chapter 102. Me and Bobby had a little reunion drink in the Black Bridge, after we all left here. In Le Pont Noir, anyway.
Jason Ritchie takes a swig from his bottle of beer.
Ron has a beer too, as he always does if Jason is around.
It is important to be a role model.
You could tell we sort of trusted each other, you know?
It felt like we'd both changed for the better over the years.
Bobby wouldn't let on what he's up to these days, but he seemed happy, so fair play.
I don't suppose anyone wants to tell me what he does now.
Jason looks expectantly at Elizabeth and Joyce and they both shake their heads.
Good, says Jason.
No one likes a grass.
But we still couldn't be sure, you know?
Couldn't be certain one of us hadn't done it.
Couldn't be sure that it was Johnny, alive and kicking and back for revenge.
So I made a call.
Oh, who to? Asks Joyce.
Jason smiles.
What does no one like, Joyce?
Joyce nods her defeat.
A grass, Jason.
Let's say I called a friend, someone we all trusted, but someone who Johnny would have trusted too, for different reasons.
And he came down, no choice, really, if it's the two of us ringing, and we asked him straight out.
Has Johnny been over?
You seen him?
Just between us and it never goes further.
And had he, asks Elizabeth.
He had, says Jason.
Johnny came over 3 days before Tony was murdered and left the day he died.
He blamed Tony for grossing him up all those years ago, so he said.
Who knows with Johnny?
Joyce nods sagely and Jason continues.
Maybe he just felt the time was right. Put the record straight. Some people have long memories. And you trust this source?
And Peter trusts him, asks Elizabeth.
Peter, asks Jason.
Sorry, Bobby, says Elizabeth.
That's my age showing.
You and Bobby both trust him.
With our lives, Jason says.
He's the straightest shooter you'll find.
And he had his reasons to help Johnny.
If your friends in the police don't work out who the guy is, then I promise I'll tell them.
But I reckon they're bright enough to work it out.
Why did Johnny send you the photograph, Jason?
Asks Ibrahim.
Jason shrugs.
I think he just wanted us to know it was him.
Showing off.
Johnny was always like that.
He could find my address pretty easy too, everyone knows me round here.
Whatever Johnny did, he always had to tell you.
And did Johnny look the same?
What was his new name? Asks Elizabeth.
Jason shakes his head.
None of our business.
We just asked what we asked.
We just wanted to know for sure.
That was enough.
Shame, says Elizabeth.
Well, if the police don't track him down, I'm sure you four will, says Jason.
And listen, me and Bobby, we just wanted to say thank you.
For bringing us together and for helping us get to the truth.
None of this would have happened without you.
Let's be honest, without you I'd probably be banged up for this.
So I got you all a little something, if that's okay.
That's definitely okay.
Jason unzips a sports bag at his feet and pulls out his gifts.
He hands a wooden box to Ibrahim.
Ibrahim, cigars, Cuban, of course.
That is the height of urbanity,
Jason, thank you, says Ibrahim.
The next gift goes to Ron.
Dad, a bottle of wine, and a nice one too.
You can stop pretending you still prefer beer in front of me.
Ron takes his gift.
Oh, a drop of white.
Thanks, Jace.
Jason hands Joyce an envelope.
Joyce, two tickets to come up and see Celebrity Ice Dance being filmed next month.
Joyce beams.
VIP, all that.
I thought you could bring Joanna.
Not Joanna, says Joyce.
It's ITV, and she won't have that on.
And Elizabeth, says Jason, with nothing in his hand but his phone.
My gift to you is this.
Jason holds up his phone and, very deliberately, swipes his finger across the screen and then puts it back in his pocket.
He looks to Elizabeth, who isn't sure how to react.
Well, thank you, Jason, although I was rather hoping for some Coco by Chanel, says Elizabeth.
I think I know what you'd like more than that though, says Jason.
To catch whoever killed Ian Ventham.
Is that in your gift,
Jason?
Asks Elizabeth.
I reckon it is.
Dad and I worked it out.
Didn't we, Dad?
Ron nods.
We did, son.
And, without wanting to sound cocky, says Jason, I reckon that one little swipe will confirm it.
Chapter 103.
Joyce, I wonder if you know about Tinder?
I had heard about it on the radio, heard jokes about it, but I had never seen it before Jason showed me.
If you know what it is, then you can skip through this bit.
So Tinder is for dating.
You post pictures of yourself on an app.
An app is like the internet, but only on your phone.
Jason showed me some of the pictures.
The pictures of the men are usually on a mountain, or chopping down a tree.
Sometimes the pictures have been cropped down the middle to cut out a former partner.
Thanks to my picture in Cut to the Chase, I know how they do that now.
The pictures of the women are often on boats, or with groups of other women, and you're not sure which one you're supposed to be looking at, so I suppose you take potluck.
I asked him if people use it for one-night stands and he says that, by and large, people use it for little else.
Well, that's a bit of fun, you could say, but the whole thing felt unhappy to me.
And the more smiles I saw, the unhappier I felt.
Perhaps that's just me.
I met Gary at a dance I had decided to go to at the last minute to spite my mother.
If I hadn't gone, then we never would have met. So I know that's an inefficient way of finding true love, but it worked for us. From the moment I laid my eyes on him, he didn't stand a chance. The lucky thing. So, on Tinder you scroll through photographs of single people who live nearby. Or sometimes married people who live nearby. There is a picture of Ian Ventham on Tinder, in a karate suit, even though he's dead. Every time you like the look of someone, you swipe their picture to the right, or to the left, I can't remember. Meanwhile, somewhere nearby they are scrolling through pictures too, and if they like the look of you, they also swipe to the right, or left, and the two of you are a match. Honestly, it breaks your heart to scroll through. It's reminded me of those photos of lost cats you see on lampposts. It's all that hope, I think. Anyway, when Jason swiped left or right, he was confident of a match. And he was confident that match would be the killer. I trust his confidence on the first matter, I am more dubious about the second. There is another dating app for gay men called Grindr. Perhaps it's for gay women too? I don't know, I didn't ask. Would they use the same one? That would be nice, I think. So Jason imagines he has solved the case. And perhaps he has, though I doubt it very much. He says it's obvious, but often, in these matters, the answer isn't obvious at all. At least I have discovered that online dating is not for me. You can have too much choice in this world. And when everyone has too much choice, it is also much harder to get chosen. And we all want to be chosen. Good night all. Good night Bernard. And good night Gary, my love. Chapter 104. Having spent a very happy morning preparing, changing outfits, and texting friends, Karen Playfair is now alone for a moment, sitting in an unfamiliar armchair. She is shaking her head, thinking about the optimism of this morning and then the reality of the lunch she's just had. Karen has had some bad dates on Tinder. But this was the first time that someone had accused her of murder. The match had pinged onto her phone yesterday evening. Jason Ritchie. Well, I don't mind if I do, she had thought. This is a cut above your average. He'd messaged, she'd messaged, and before you knew it, there they were in Le Pont Noir, ordering a crayfish salad with radicchio. A whirlwind romance in the offing. Karen shifts in her armchair and idly picks up a magazine from a pile on the coffee table. It's more of a newsletter, really. Cut to the chase. Back to the date. There had been some small talk, not too much. Karen knew very little about boxing and Jason knew very little about IT. Lightly sparkling water arrived, and that's when Jason mentioned Ian Ventham. Karen immediately realized that this wasn't a date, and felt foolish. But worse was to come. She can hear Ron Ritchie in his kitchen now, he's opening a bottle of wine. Jason's nip to the loo. She starts flicking through Cut to the Chase, but her mind keeps going back to Le Pont Noir. All those questions Jason had fired at her. Hadn't she been there the morning Ian Ventham was killed? Yes, she had. Wasn't her dad refusing to sell his land to Ian Ventham? Well, yes he was, but, look, here comes our crayfish. Didn't she want her dad to sell the land, to take the money? That was her advice. Yes, but it was her dad's business. Surely if he sold, then some of that money would be coming to her? Well, you could certainly assume that, Jason, but why not just come out with it and say what you want to say? And so he did. It was almost funny, thinks Karen, reliving it. She hears the loo flush. What was it he had said? Jason had leaned forward, very sure, certain. In fact, you see, the police had been looking for someone who was there in the 1970s and was still there now, and they had been right in a way. They'd found bones and maybe someone had been murdered, all those years ago. But forget the bones, they were missing the simplest trick in the book, greed. Ventham was in the way of Karen making her millions. Her dad wasn't budging, and so Ventham had to go. Jason mentioned some drugs you could only get on the dark web, and didn't Karen work in IT? Wasn't that convenient? Jason had solved the case and felt sure he was about to get a confession. Honestly, some men. He hadn't expected Karen to laugh in his face and explain that she was a database administrator for a secondary school, who could no more access the dark web than fly to the moon. That she had misheard Jason's mention of fentanyl as Ventolin and had wondered what he was on about. That she lived in one of the most beautiful places in England, and while she would certainly swap that for £1 million, she would rather be there with her dad happy, than in some executive new build in Hove, with her dad miserable. Jason looked like he was going to come back with a clever response, but, when he tried, none came. Jason walks back into the room and Karen remembers how crestfallen he had looked. He knew she was telling him the truth. That his little theory was wrong. He had apologized and offered to leave, but Karen had wondered if they shouldn't make the best out of a bad deal and enjoy the rest of their lunch. What if they ended up together? Wouldn't this be the greatest and how did you two meet story of all time? Which set them both laughing and set them both talking and turned the whole thing into a lovely, long, boozy lunch. Which is why Jason had asked her back here for another drink and to do a bit of explaining to his dad. Right on cue, Ron Ritchie walks in with a nice bottle of white and three glasses. Jason sits down next to her and takes the glasses from his dad. He really has been charm itself since he accused her of murder. Karen Playfair puts her copy of Cut to the Chase back down on the pile. And as she does, she sees the photograph. Halfway down the page. She picks the newsletter up again and stares closely. Just to make sure. You all right, Karen? Asks Jason, as Ron pours the wine. The police wanted someone who was here in the 70s, who's still here now, asks Karen, slowly and carefully. That's what they reckon, says Jason. Obviously, I thought they were wrong, but we saw how that played out. Jason laughs, but Karen does not. She looks at Ron and points to the face in the photograph. Someone who was here in the 70s and is still here now. Ron looks, but his brain won't take it in. You're sure? He manages to ask. It was a long time ago, but I'm sure. Ron's mind is traveling at speed. This can't be. He's searching for reasons why this must be wrong, but can find none. He puts the wine down on the coffee table and picks up Cut to the Chase. I need to go and talk to Elizabeth. Chapter 105. Steve's gym looks a lot like its owner. A squat, brick building, intimidating at first sight, but with the door always open and everyone always welcome. Chris and Donna step over the threshold. After the excitement in the graveyard yesterday, Chris and Donna had gone back to Fairhaven and checked on Joe Cipriano's hunch about the original investigation. No one from Kent police had ventured into northern Cyprus. There was no mention of Gianni's family connections. There had been no meaningful investigation at all. Chris had seen the names of the two officers who had been sent to Nicosia. No surprises. They'd have come back with tans and hangovers and nothing else. He and Donna had then been having another look at all those passenger lists, coming in from Larnaca to Heathrow and Gatwick in the week before the murder. Nearly 3,000 names, mainly men, and mainly Cypriots. Looking through list after list of names, Chris remembered something else that Joe Cipriano had said. If Johnny had come to the UK, he would have needed help. A fellow Cypriot would be the obvious choice. Did Chris know any? As the names flashed before his eyes, he realized that he did. They had then gone back to the original Tony Curran file. There was no doubt that, in the early days, Steve Georgiou had been in and around the Tony Curran crew. Mentioned in dispatches, but never anything to bring him in for. And whatever he had been doing for Tony hadn't lasted long. He'd opened Steve's gym ages ago and it had gone from strength to strength, as it were. Chris and Donna both knew officers who trained there. Decent officers too, not fools. The place had a good reputation, and that wasn't the case with all gyms. Even today the gym was packed. A Wednesday afternoon, an atmosphere of quiet hard work, no preening and posturing. Chris has been meaning to join a gym, but at the moment he was waiting for his knee to stop hurting. No point aggravating it. As soon as it has settled down, he'll join. Take the bull by the horns. He had felt a sharp, stabbing pain in his arm after the run up the hill to the graveyard to save Elizabeth. Almost certainly nothing, but even so. Steve had been expecting them and met them by the door with a crushing handshake and a huge smile. They are now in his office. Steve is sitting on a yoga ball and chatting happily. "Listen, you know as well as anyone, we don't have trouble here, and we don't cause trouble here," says Steve Georgiou. "I do know that," agrees Chris. "The opposite, in it. You know that. We take people in, we turn them around. No secrets, you just ask whatever, yeah. I was in Cyprus recently, Steve." Steve stops smiling and bounces a little. "Okay, I didn't really know much about it before I went, I just thought holidays, you know. It's very beautiful," says Steve Georgiou. "Are we just gossiping or what? What are you, Steve? Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot?" asks Donna. "There's a beat, very short, but very telling to a good copper." Steve shakes his head. "I don't get involved in all that, not for me. People are people." "We're agreed on that, Steve," says Chris. "But even so. What side of the line were you? We can probably find out another way, but since we're here, Turkish," says Steve Georgiou. "Turkish Cypriot." He shrugs, "It's of no concern." Chris nods his head and writes something down, just keeping Steve waiting for a moment. Like Johnny Gunn does. Steve Georgiou tilts his head to the side and looks at Chris anew. "That's a name from a long time ago. Isn't it, though?" says Chris. "Anyway, that's why I was in Cyprus. Trying to track him down." Steve Georgiou smiles. "He's long gone. Johnny was crazy. Good luck to the guy, but someone would have killed him by now. Guaranteed. Well, that would explain why we can't find him. But, you know, Steve, I'm a police officer, and sometimes something doesn't seem right. That's the job, in it," says Steve Georgiou. "I want to suggest a story," says Chris. "Just something we've been thinking about. And you don't have to say anything. You don't have to react, just listen. Can you do that?" "I've got to be honest with you, I've got a gym to run and I still don't know what you're doing here." Donna holds up a hand and concedes the point. "You're right. But just hear us out. 2 minutes and you'll be back out there. 2 minutes, except Steve. You're one of the good guys, Steve," says Chris. "I know that, I don't hear a bad word about you." "I appreciate that, thank you," says Steve. "But here's what I worry has happened," continues Chris. "I think a few weeks ago you get a message, or maybe it's just a knock at the door, I don't know. Either way, it's Johnny Gunn does." "Nope," says Steve Georgiou, shaking his head. "And Johnny needs help. He's back in town for something. Maybe he doesn't say what, maybe he does. And he turns to you, a little favor, for old time's sake. Somewhere to stay? Maybe just that. He doesn't want a record of whatever his new name is anywhere in town. And no one's to know. I haven't seen Johnny Gunn does in 20 years. He's dead, or he's in prison, or he's in Turkey," says Steve Georgiou. "Maybe," says Chris. "But Johnny could be trouble if he doesn't get what he wants. He could burn this place down pretty easily, I'd have thought. He's the type to do it too, so maybe you had no choice? And it's only a couple of days. He's just got to deliver a couple of things, then tie up a loose end. Then he'd be gone. How does that sound to you, Steve?" Steve Georgiou shrugs. like a pretty dangerous story.
You've got a flat above the gym, asks Donna.
Steve nods.
Who stays there?
Anyone who needs to.
Not everyone who comes in here is from a stable background.
A kid tells me he can't go home, I don't ask the reason, I just hand him the keys.
It's a safe place.
Who was staying in the flat on June the 17th? Asks Chris.
No idea, I'm not the Hilton.
Maybe some kid, maybe me.
Maybe no one, asks Donna.
Steve George shrugs.
But you think maybe someone, says Chris.
Maybe.
Johnny is very well connected, Steve.
In Cyprus, says Chris.
Not my world.
You've still got family over there, asks Donna.
Yes, says Steve George.
Lot of family.
Steve, if Johnny Gundas had come here and asked if he could stay, begins Chris.
If he put pressure on you of any kind.
Or maybe he paid you.
If you agreed.
If he slept upstairs on June 17th.
There's no way you would tell me.
No consequences too great?
Consequences for family in Cyprus.
I think that's been 2 minutes, if we're honest.
Agreed, says Chris.
Thank you, Steve.
Anytime.
You're always welcome here.
I mean that.
We could sort that gut out in a heartbeat.
Chris smiles.
It had crossed my mind, Steve.
I don't suppose there's any way I could take a look upstairs before I go?
Just see if Johnny left anything.
Steve George shakes his head.
You could do me a favor though.
Go on, says Chris.
Could you stick this in lost property?
Someone dropped it a couple of weeks ago and I've asked and asked, but I don't know who it belongs to.
Steve reaches into a drawer and pulls out a clear plastic wallet, filled with cash, and hands it to Chris.
5,000 euros.
Some tourist must be kicking themselves.
Chris looks at the cash, looks at Donna, then back at Steve.
Would this have prints on it?
Doubtful, but at least Steve is letting him know he's right.
You don't want to keep it?
Steve George shakes his head.
Nope, I know where it's been.
Chris hands the envelope to Donna and she puts it in an evidence bag.
They both know that Steve George has just been very brave.
Chris stands and shakes him by the hand.
I know Tony Curran was a bastard, says Steve George.
But he didn't deserve that.
Agreed, says Chris.
Up to a point.
Anyway.
Me and my gut will be back here soon.
Good lad.
Chapter 106. Elizabeth leaves Stephen sleeping.
Bogdan will be around after work for a game of chess.
She hopes they will both be there when she gets back.
She'll need the company.
The knob has come off the bedroom wardrobe door and Elizabeth casually leaves it on the kitchen table.
She bets that Bogdan won't be able to resist fixing it.
Ron had come to her with the photograph that Karen Playfair had seen.
Karen would have been young at the time, but she was sure.
Elizabeth had tried to piece it all together in her head.
It seemed impossible at first.
But the more she thought about it, it began to seem horribly true.
She worked out the steps, one by one.
Ibrahim had come back an hour ago, with the final piece of the jigsaw, so now is the time.
The case is solved and only justice remains.
Elizabeth walks out into the cold evening air, not turning back now.
The skies are getting darker earlier and the scarves are coming out of the wardrobes.
Summer is still keeping a lid on autumn, but it won't be long.
How many more autumns for Elizabeth?
How many more years of slipping on a pair of comfortable boots and walking through the leaves?
One day, spring will come without her.
The daffodils will always come up by the lake, but you won't always be there to see them.
So it goes, enjoy them while you can.
But right now, with the job at hand, Elizabeth feels an affinity with the late summer.
The leaves clinging gamely on, the last hurrah of the heat, the odd trick still up its sleeve.
She sees Ron making his way over, grim-faced, but ready.
Hiding his limp,
keeping his pain to himself. What a fine friend Ron is, she thinks. What a heart he has. Long may it go on beating. As she turns the corner, she sees Ibrahim waiting by the door, folder in hand. The last piece of the jigsaw. How handsome he looks, dressed for the occasion, ready to do whatever's necessary. That Ibrahim might ever die seems absurd to Elizabeth. He will certainly be the last of them. The last oak in the forest, standing still and true, as the aeroplanes whizz overhead. How to begin? Thinks Elizabeth. How to even begin? Chapter 107. Chris gets the nod. An international warrant has been issued for the arrest of Johnny Gundas for questioning over the murder of Tony Curran. A good end to the day. The euro Steve Georgia gave them had no prints, but had been taken out at a bureau de change in northern Cyprus 3 days before Tony Curran's murder. He'd given Joe Kiprianou the address of the bureau, in case of CCTV, but Joe had taken one look at the address and left. No chance. Would the Cypriot authorities ever find him? Who knew? You'd think so, but after the initial rush, how hard is anyone really going to look? Maybe Chris will even get another trip over to Cyprus. That would be nice. Either way, he's done all he can and it's up to the Cypriots now, if they fancy their chances. Whatever happens, Chris will look good. It is a cause for celebration, but Chris has had too many nights in the pub with too many coppers over the years. What he'd really wanted was a curry at home, get Don around, watch something on TV, bottle of wine and send her home at 10. Maybe talk a bit about Ventham. What have they missed? Chris had a worrying thought earlier. A stupid one, really. Only, hadn't the convent had a hospital, all those years ago? Wasn't Joyce an ex-nurse? Run the name Joyce Meadowcroft through the computer? Could he talk to Donna about it? But Donna had a mystery date tonight. Casually dropped it into the conversation on the way back from Steve's gym. So, he would go home and have a night in by himself, with a curry. Chris knew that was where this was heading. The darts was on Sky. Chris wondered whether this was a tragic plan, or simply the sort of plan that people would think was tragic. Was he a content man, doing the things he liked alone? Or was he a lonely man, making the best out of what he had? Alone, or lonely? This question cropped up so often these days, Chris could no longer be confident of his answer. Though if he were a betting man, his money would be on lonely. Where was his date? If he leaves right now, it will be rush hour. So Chris closes the Tony Curran file and opens up the Ventham file. If he can solve one murder, he can surely solve two more? What has he missed? Who has he missed? Chapter 108. They make their way along the corridor, Elizabeth and Ibrahim, with Ron carrying a couple of extra chairs. A job to do. Behind them, double doors swing open and Joyce hurries after her friends. Sorry I'm late. The beeper was going off on my oven and I couldn't work out why. Sometimes it can be a very brief power outage. Then the clock tries to reset itself, says Ibrahim. Joyce nods. Without thinking, she takes Ibrahim's hand. Ahead of them Elizabeth has taken Ron's hand too and they walk in silence until they reach the door. Despite the circumstances, Elizabeth knocks. As she always does. She opens the door and there he is. The man Karen Playfair had recognized after all those years. His picture next to Ron, holding the fox that he had saved. The same old book is open at the same old page. He looks up and seems unsurprised to see the four of them. Ah, the gang's all here. The gang's all here, John, confirms Elizabeth. Do you mind if we sit? John gestures for them to do exactly that. He puts down his book and pinches the bridge of his nose. Ron looks over at Penny, comatose on the bed. Nothing left of her, really, he thinks. Gone. Why hasn't he been to see her? Why had it taken this? How shall we do this, John? Asks Elizabeth.
Up to you, Elizabeth, replies John. I've been waiting for that knock since the moment I did it. Just took each day as a bonus. I do wish you'd taken a bit longer, though.
What was it, in the end?
Karen Playfair recognized you, said Ibrahim.
John nods and smiles to himself.
Did she?
Little Karen.
Goodness. You put her dog to sleep when she was six, John, says Joyce.
She says she would never forget your kind eyes.
Elizabeth is in her customary seat at the foot of Penny's bed.
Do you want to start, John?
Or shall we?
Shall I, says John, and shuts his eyes.
I've been over it so many times in my head.
Who is in the grave, John?
Whose bones are they?
Eyes still shut, John looks up to the heavens, lets out a sigh from the ages and begins.
It would have been the early 70s, maybe 10 miles from here.
Gray Scott, one of the sheep farms.
There used to be any number around here, you know.
Long time ago now.
I think I'd started in 1967, Penny would remember for sure, but around then anyway.
The farmer was an old boy called Matheson and I knew him well enough by that point.
I'd go out there every now and again.
You know, something would happen.
This time around, he'd had a mare just given birth.
The foal had died and the mare was in distress.
She was in such pain, screaming, and he hadn't wanted to shoot her, which I understood, so I gave her an injection and that was that.
Done it many times, before and since.
Some farmers will just shoot them, some vets will too, but not Matheson and not me.
Anyway, he made me a cup of tea and we got chatting.
I was always in a hurry, but I think he was a very lonely man.
There was no family, no one to help him on the farm, money running out, so I think he welcomed the company.
It was very bleak up there, that's how it seemed to me that day.
I had to be on my way, but he didn't want me to leave.
You will judge me, I know, or perhaps you won't, but suddenly something seemed clear as day to me.
He was in distress, great distress.
If Matheson had been an animal, he would have been screaming.
You have to believe that.
And so I reached into my bag and I offered him a flu shot, you know, see him through the winter and all that.
He was glad of the offer.
He rolled up his sleeve and I gave him his shot.
The same shot I'd just given the mare.
And that was the end of the screaming and the end of the pain.
You put him out of his misery, John, asks Joyce.
That's how I saw it.
Then and now.
If I'd had my wits about me, I would have conjured up some clever little concoction, something that wouldn't show up in a post-mortem, and left him there to be found by the postman, or the milk van, or whoever knocked there next. But it was spur of the moment, so there he was, pumped full of pentobarbital, and I couldn't take the risk that someone might look into it.
So you had to bury him.
This Matheson, asks Elizabeth.
Quite so.
I would have buried him there and then, but you'll remember they were buying up farmland left, right and center those days, building houses everywhere, and I thought it'd be just my luck to bury him, then have him dug up by builders a month later.
And that's when I remembered.
The graveyard, says Ron.
It was perfect.
I knew it from visiting Gordon Playfair.
It wasn't on farmland, and no one was going to be buying a convent, for heaven's sake.
I knew how quiet it was, I knew no one visited.
So I drove up one night, a couple of days later, lights off.
Picked up my spade and did the deed.
And that was that, until one day, 40 years later, I saw an advert for this place.
And here we all are, says Elizabeth.
And here we all are.
I persuaded Penny it would be a lovely place to retire to, and I wasn't wrong there.
I just wanted to keep an eye on things.
You think they won't dig up a graveyard, but you never know these days, and I wanted to be close by in case the worst happened.
Which it did, John, says Joyce.
I couldn't dig the body back up, too old, too feeble. and I couldn't risk the grave being dug up and the body being found. So in the panic of that morning, in all the chaos while we were holding him back, I slid a syringe into Ventham's arm and seconds later he was dead. Which is unforgivable in every way. Unforgivable. And from that moment I've been waiting for you to come, and I've been waiting to face the consequences of what I've done. How did you magically have a syringe filled with fentanyl, John? Asks Elizabeth. John smiles. I've had it for a long time. In case I ever needed it here. If they ever wanted to move Penny. John looks at Elizabeth, through clear eyes. I'm glad it was you at least, Elizabeth, and not the police. I'm glad you solved it. I knew you would. I'm glad too, John, says Elizabeth. And thank you for telling your story. You know we will have to tell the police. I know. We don't need to do it this very second though. While it's just us, can I clarify two little things? Of course. It was a long time ago, but I'll help if I can. I think you and I agree, John, that Penny probably doesn't hear what goes on in this room. Whatever silly nonsense we say to her. That we're kidding ourselves, really. John nods. But I think we're also agreed that maybe she can? Just maybe. Maybe she hears it all. Maybe, agrees John. In which case, John, perhaps she can hear us now. Perhaps. Even if there's the slightest chance, John. The slightest chance that Penny heard what you just said. Why would you do that to her? Why put her through that? Well, you wouldn't, John, that's the truth. That would have been torture, says Elizabeth. Ibrahim sits forward. John, you said that killing Ian Ventham was unforgivable. And I believe, truly, that you mean that. It was an act beyond your imagining. And yet you ask us to believe that you committed that act simply to save your own skin? That doesn't ring true, I'm afraid. You committed an act you knew to be unforgivable. And I'm afraid we see only one reason for that. Love, John, says Joyce. Always love. John looks at the four of them. Each implacable. I sent Ibrahim to have a look at one of Penny's files this morning, says Elizabeth. Ibrahim. Ibrahim takes a small manila file from his shopping bag and hands it to Elizabeth. She opens the file on her lap. Shall we get to the truth? Chapter 109. Chris is alone. The remains of a takeaway curry are in front of him. Michael Van Gerwen dispatched Peter Wright by 6 sets to love, finishing the darts early. So now there is nothing on TV and no one to watch it with. He is wondering whether he should go to the 24-hour garage for some crisps. Just to take the edge off. His phone buzzes. That's something, at least. It's Donna. Might watch Jason Ritchie's famous Family Trees on catch-up. You fancy? Chris looks at his watch, it's nearly 10. Why not? Another buzz. And wear your dark blue shirt, please. The one with the buttons. Chris is used to Donna by now, so does as he is told. As always, he gets changed without looking in a mirror, because who wants to see that? He texts back. Yes, ma'am, anything for a bit of Jason Ritchie. On my way. Donna's date had clearly not been a roaring success. 110 She keeps them in storage, John, says Elizabeth, holding the manila file. I don't know if you've ever been? It's files of all her old cases. You're not supposed to keep them, but you know Penny. She made copies of everything, just in case. In case they might help catch a killer many years later, says Joyce. Anyway, John, after Karen Playfair recognized you, it got me thinking, and I just needed one final thing checking in one of the files. Would you like some water, John? Asks Joyce. John shakes his head. His eyes are on Elizabeth as she begins to read from the file. There was a case in Rye, in 1973.
Penny must have been very junior. I can't imagine Penny ever having been junior, but you must remember it very clearly. Probably seems like yesterday. The case concerned a girl named Annie Madeley. You remember Annie Madeley, Penny? Elizabeth looks over to where her friend is lying. Listening.
Not listening?
Stabbed during a burglary and bled to death in the arms of her boyfriend. Around came the police, including Penny, that's in the file. Found broken glass on the floor, where our burglar had got in, but nothing stolen. The burglar had been surprised by Annie Madeley, panicked, picked up a kitchen knife, stabbed her and fled. That's the official account if you want to read it. Case closed. But Ron was the first to sniff it out, he didn't like it one bit. It stunk, Johnny, says Ron. A burglar in the middle of the day, on a busy estate? With people at home? You might burgle on a Sunday morning, while everyone is at church, but not Sunday afternoon, not the done thing. Elizabeth looks over to her friend. You must have thought that too, Penny. You must have known the boyfriend had stabbed her, waited for her to die, then called the police. She dabs Penny's dry lips. We started looking into it months ago, John. The Thursday Murder Club. No Penny, but we carried on. I was surprised we'd never looked at the case before, surprised Penny had never brought it in. We started looking at it, John, seeing if the police had got it wrong all those years ago. I read the report on the knife wound and it didn't seem right to me, so I asked Joyce about it. In fact, it might have been the first thing I ever asked you, Joyce. It was, remembers Joyce. I described the wound and asked her how long it would take to die, and she said around 45 minutes or so, which didn't fit the boyfriend's account at all. He had chased the burglar, no one saw this, John, rushed back to the kitchen, held Annie Madeley in his arms and rang the police immediately. I then asked Joyce if someone with any medical training could have saved her and what did you say, Joyce? I was certain, it would have been easy. You'll know that too, John, with your training. Now the boyfriend had been a soldier, John, invalided out a few years before. So he could have saved her, no question. But that's not the way the investigation went. I'd like to say that things were different in these cases back then, but no doubt he'd get away with it today too. They searched for the burglar, but with no luck. Poor Annie Madeley was buried and the world kept turning. The boyfriend disappeared shortly afterwards, in the middle of the night, with rent owing and we come to the end of the file. So we were looking into all of this, but then events took over, of course, says Ibrahim. Mr. Curran, Mr. Ventham, the body in the graveyard. We put the case to one side while we had a real murder right in front of us. But we all know we don't come to the end of the story, don't we, John, says Ron. Elizabeth taps the manila file. And so I sent Ibrahim off to look at the file, with one question. Can you guess what it was, John? John stares at her. Elizabeth looks at Penny. Penny, if you can hear, I bet you know the question. Peter Mercer, that was the name of the boyfriend, Peter Mercer. I asked Ibrahim to find out why Peter Mercer had been invalid from the army. And if you hadn't guessed the question, I bet you can guess the answer, John. Have a go, it's all too late anyway. John buries his head in his hands, drags them down his face and looks up. I assume, Elizabeth, it was a gunshot wound to the lower leg. It was just that, John. Elizabeth pulls her chair nearer to Penny, takes her hand and speaks to her quietly and directly. Nearly 50 years ago, Peter Mercer murdered his girlfriend, then vanished into thin air. And everyone thought he'd got away with it. But it's really not all that easy to get away with murder, is it, Penny? Sometimes justice is waiting just around the corner, as it was for Peter Mercer one dark night when you paid him a visit. And sometimes justice waits 50 years and sits beside a hospital bed holding the hand of a friend. Had you just seen one too many of these cases, Penny?
Tired of it?
And tired of no one listening. When did she tell you, John? Asks Joyce. John starts to cry. When she was first ill. John nods slowly. She didn't mean to tell me. You remember how she was, Elizabeth? The mini strokes.
Yes, remembers Elizabeth.
They were very gentle at first. Nothing too alarming, unless you knew what they were. But poor John had known exactly what they were. She would say all sorts of things. See all sorts of things. Plenty of make-believe, and then the present sort of disappeared and her mind would go further and further back. Kept spooling back until it found something familiar, I suppose. Just looking for something that made sense, because the world around her had stopped making sense. So she'd tell me stories, sometimes from her childhood, sometimes from when we first met. And sometimes from her early days in the police, prompts Elizabeth. All things I'd heard before at first. Things I remember from the time, old bosses, little scams they'd pull, fiddling expenses, pub instead of court, the sorts of things we'd always laughed about. I knew she was adrift and I wanted to hold on to her as long as I could. Do you understand?
We all do, John, says Ron.
And they do. So I would keep her talking. The same stories over and over again sometimes. One reminding her of another, reminding her of another, reminding her of the first one again, and round we'd go. But then, John pauses and looks at his wife. You say you don't really think Penny can hear you, John, says Elizabeth. John shakes his head, slowly. No, and yet every day, you come here. You sit with her. You talk to her. What else is there for me to do, Elizabeth? Elizabeth understands. So, she was telling you stories. Stories you knew. And then one day.
Yes, and then one day it was stories I didn't know.
Secrets, says Ron. Secrets. Nothing awful, only little things. She'd taken money once. A bribe. Everyone else had taken it and she felt she'd had to. She told me that as if she had told me many times before, but she hadn't. We all have secrets, don't we?
We do, John, agrees Elizabeth.
She'd forgotten what was a funny story and what was a secret. But there must have been something still working, a final lock on a final gate. The last thing to give. The worst secret of all. John nods. By God, she held onto it. She was already in here. You remember when they moved her in?
Elizabeth remembers.
Penny had gone by this time. Conversations were snippets, incoherent, sometimes angry. When would Stephen come in here? She needed to get back to him. Just get this done and go home and kiss her beautiful husband. She didn't even recognize me by then. Well, she recognized me, but she couldn't place me. I came in one morning. About 2 months ago, you know, and she was sitting up. It was the last time I remember her sitting up. And she saw me, and she knew me. She asked me what we were going to do and I didn't understand the question, so I asked her, do about what? Elizabeth nods. And she started to tell me, and she was very matter of fact. As if there was something in the loft and she needed me to get it down. Nothing more than that. Nothing more than that. You know I couldn't let people find out what she'd done, Elizabeth. You know that? I had to try something. Elizabeth nods. We'd picnicked up on the hill a few times, John continues. It really was very beautiful. I'd always wondered why we stopped. They sit in silence. Broken only by the quiet electronic beeps by Penny's bedside. All that remained of her, like a lighthouse blinking far out to sea. Elizabeth gently breaks the silence. Here's what I think we should do, John. I'm going to get the others to take you home. It's late, have a sleep in your own bed.
If you have letters to write, then write them.
I'll come with the police in the morning.
I know you'll be there.
We'll step outside for a moment so you can say goodbye to Penny.
The four friends step outside and Elizabeth watches through the clear border of the frosted window in Penny's door as John holds his wife in his arms.
She looks away.
You'll see John back safely, won't you?
If I stay with Penny for a moment, she asks the others, and gets nods in return.
She opens the door again.
John is putting on his coat.
Time to go, John.
Chapter 111.
The lights in Donna's flat are low and Stevie Wonder is working his magic from the speakers.
Chris is happy and relaxed, shoes off, feet up.
Donna pours him a glass of wine.
Thanks, Donna.
Pleasure.
Nice shirt, by the way.
Why, thank you.
It's just something I threw on.
Chris smiles at Donna and Donna smiles back.
Donna can sense what is about to happen and it makes her very happy.
Mum, inquires Donna, holding the bottle towards her mother.
Thank you, darling, I will.
Donna then pours a glass of wine for her mother, currently sitting beside Chris on the sofa.
Honestly, you could be her sister, Patrice, says Chris.
And I'm not just saying that because Donna is aging so badly.
Donna mimes throwing up while Patrice laughs.
Madonna told me you were charming.
Chris puts down his wine, a look of delight creeping onto his face.
Sorry?
Who told you I was charming?
Madonna, she tilts her head towards her daughter.
Chris looks at Donna.
Your full name is Madonna.
If you ever call me that, I will taser you, says Donna.
It would be worth it, says Chris.
Patrice, I think I love you.
Donna rolls her eyes and picks up the remote.
Shall we watch Jason Ritchie?
Sure, sure, says Chris, distracted.
So what do you do for a living, Patrice?
I teach.
Primary, says Patrice.
Do you, says Chris.
Teacher, sings in a choir, loves dogs, that's his fantasy checklist.
Donna looks Chris straight in the eye.
And she sings in the choir on a Sunday.
Chris refuses to hold Donna's gaze and turns back to Patrice.
This is going to sound like a ridiculous question, Patrice, but do you like dogs?
Patrice takes a sip of her wine.
Allergic, I'm afraid.
Chris nods, and sips, then gives his glass an almost imperceptible raise towards Donna.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
He is glad he is wearing his blue shirt with the buttons.
What happened to your date?
Chris asks Donna.
I just said I had a date.
I didn't say it was my date, replies Donna.
Donna's phone buzzes.
She looks at the screen.
It's Elizabeth.
She wonders if we're free tomorrow morning?
Nothing urgent.
Solved the case, no doubt.
Donna laughs.
She hopes everything is okay with her friend.
Chapter 112.
Penny's bedside lamp is turned as low as it can go, just enough light for two old friends with familiar faces.
Elizabeth has Penny's hand in hers.
So, did anyone get away with anything, darling?
Tony Curran didn't, did he?
Someone did for him.
Johnny, so everyone seems to think, though I have a theory about that I must discuss with Joyce.
No loss there, anyway.
And Ventham?
Well, you know John has to pay for that.
I'll take the police there in the morning and they'll find his body, we both know that.
The moment he's home, a little nightcap and that's that.
He knows enough to make it peaceful at least, doesn't he?
Elizabeth strokes Penny's hair.
And what about you, darling?
You clever girl.
Did you get away with it?
I know why you did what you did, Penny. I see the choice you made, to deliver your own justice.
I don't agree with it, but I see it.
I wasn't there.
I wasn't facing what you were facing.
But did you get away with it?
Elizabeth places Penny's hand back on the bed and stands.
It all rather depends, doesn't it?
On whether you can hear me or not.
If you can hear, Penny, you'll know that the man you love has just walked off into the night to die. All because he wanted to protect you. And that all comes down to the choice you made all those years ago. And I think that's punishment enough, Penny. Elizabeth starts to put on her coat. And if you can't hear me, then you got away with it, dear. Bravo. Elizabeth's coat is now on and she places a hand on her friend's cheek. I know what John did while he was holding you, Penny, I saw the syringe. So I know you're off too, and that this is goodbye. Darling, I haven't really spoken about Stephen recently. He's not at all well and I'm trying my best, but I'm losing him bit by bit. So I have my secrets too. She kisses Penny's cheek. Dear God, I will miss you, you fool. Sweet dreams, darling. What a chase. Elizabeth leaves Willows and walks out into the darkness. A quiet, cloudless night. A night so dark you think you might never see morning again. Chapter 113. Chris takes a taxi home and walks the long walk up to his flat. Is it the booze, or is he a little lighter on his feet? He opens his front door and surveys the scene. A few things would need to be tidied away for sure, take the recycling out, maybe buy some cushions and a candle? The bathroom door still stuck whenever it was opened, but nothing that a bit of sandpaper and hard work wouldn't fix. Go to Tesco's, buy some fruit, put it in a bowl on the dining table. Of course, also buy a fruit bowl. Clean the bedding. Replace toothbrush. Buy towels. That should do it. Just enough to convince Patrice that he was a regular human being and not a man who had given up on life. It didn't take much. Then he could send her a text, invite her round for dinner while she was in Fairhaven. Flowers. Why not? Go crazy. Chris switches on his computer and waits for his emails to load. A bad habit, checking in before bedtime. Delaying bedtime, usually. 3 new emails, nothing that looked like it would detain him. One of his sergeants was doing a triathlon, a cry for help, for which he expected to be sponsored. An invitation to the Kent Police Community Awards night, bring a guest. Would that count as a date? Probably not, he would check with Donna. Then an email from an account Chris didn't recognize. Didn't happen often. Chris kept his personal account as private as one could these days. From Kiprios Legal, subject, strictly private and confidential. From Cyprus? Had they found Johnny? Were solicitors warning the police off? But why would it come to his personal account? No one in Cyprus had this email address. Chris clicks on the email. Dear sir, our client, Mr. Costas Gundas, has asked us to forward this correspondence to you. Please be advised that all and any information included in this correspondence is to be treated as confidential. Please direct any reply to our offices. Your faithful servant, Gregory Ioannidis Kyprios Associates Costas Gundas? Costas, who had laughed when Chris had handed him his card? Well, wasn't this turning into quite the evening? Chris clicks on the attachment. Mr. Hudson, you say my son came back to Cyprus in 2000. You have proof of this. I need to tell you that I did not see him then and have not seen him since. Not once. I have not seen my son, I have had no letter or no call from my son. Mr. Hudson, I am old, you have seen this with your own eyes. As you look for Johnny, you must know that I too look for him. I will never speak to a police officer, you understand, but I ask for help today. If you can find Johnny, if you have information of any type, there is great, great reward for you. I fear Johnny is dead. He is my son and I want to see him before I die, or to know this is impossible and be allowed to grieve. I hope you accept this with compassion. I am asking you please. Greetings, Costas Gundas. Chris reads it through a couple more times. Nice try, Costas. Is he expecting Chris to share this with the Cypriot police? With Joe Kyprianou? Surely he is.
Does this mean the Cypriot police are getting close to Johnny? One last effort to throw them off the scent? Or is it what it says it is? A plea from an old man to find his missing son. In his younger days, Chris might have believed this. But he's seen too much, heard too much from people saving their own skins. Any story? And he knows where Johnny Gundez was on June 17th. Johnny is not dead. Johnny went home, with Tony Curran's money. He changed his name, got a nose job and whatever else his dad's money would pay for and has been living it up ever since. Johnny is sunning himself somewhere in Cyprus, happy with his lot. Without an enemy in the world, now that Tony Curran has been dealt with. Kostas Gundez will not be getting a reply. Chris shuts down his computer. He really wishes people would stop doing triathlons. Chapter 114. Elizabeth is out late, but Bogdan and Stephen have not noticed. Bogdan has his lower lip jutting out to one side as he thinks. He taps on the table, thinking about the right move. He stares across at Stephen, then back down at the board. How does this man play like this? If Bogdan isn't very, very careful, he is going to lose. And Bogdan doesn't remember the last time he lost. Bogdan, can I ask you a question, says Stephen. Always, says Bogdan. We are friends. It won't put you off? I have you in a bind here. I wonder if you need to concentrate. Stephen, we play, we talk. They are both special to me. Bogdan moves his bishop. He looks up at Stephen, who is surprised at the move, but not yet concerned. Thank you, Bogdan, they are both special to me too. So, ask me a good question. It's only this. Well, firstly, what was the name of the chap? Stephen attacks Bogdan's bishop, but senses he is being lured into something. Which chap, Stephen, asks Bogdan, looking down at the board, grateful for the chink of light which has just appeared. The first one who was killed? The builder. Tony, says Bogdan. Tony Curran. That's the one, says Stephen. He rubs his chin as Bogdan protects his bishop and opens the board at the same time. What's the question? Asks Bogdan. Well, it's just this, and forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn, but from everything I hear about it, I think you killed him. Elizabeth talks to me, you know. Stephen moves a pawn, but can see there's nothing much doing. Bogdan looks around the room for a moment, then back at Stephen. Sure, I killed him. It's a secret though, only one other person knows. Oh, mum's the word, old boy, no one will hear it from me. But I don't really understand why. Not money, surely, that doesn't seem your style at all. No, not money. You got to be careful with money. Don't let it be in charge. Bogdan advances a knight and Stephen sees what he's up to at last. Delightful, really. What was it then? It was simple, honestly. I had a friend, my best friend when I arrived in England and he drove a taxi. One day he saw Tony do something he shouldn't. What did he see? Stephen surprises Bogdan by moving his rook. Bogdan smiles a little. He loves this crafty old man. He saw Tony shoot a young boy from London. About something, I don't know, I never found out. A drug thing. So Tony killed your friend. Well, the taxi company is run by a man named Johnny. They called him Turkish Johnny, but he was Cypriot. Johnny and Tony were in business, but Tony was the boss. Bogdan stares down at the board, taking his time. So Johnny killed your friend. Johnny killed my friend, but Tony told him to. I don't care, is same thing. It is. We're agreed there. And whatever happened to Johnny? Bogdan feels the need to withdraw his knight. A waste of a move, but never mind, these things happen. I kill him too. Straight away, pretty much. Stephen nods.
He stares at the board in silence for a while. Bogdan thinks he may have lost him, but he has learned you have to be patient with Steven sometimes. And sure enough. What was your friend's name? Steven keeps looking at the board, trying to conjure something from nothing.
Kaz.
Kazimir, says Bogdan. Johnny, he asked Kaz to drive him to the woods, he has to bury something and he needs help. They walk into the woods, they dig and dig, for whatever Johnny needs to bury. He was a hard worker, Kaz, and nice, you would like him very much. So then Johnny shoot Kaz, pop, one shot, and buries him in the hole. Steven further advances his pawn. Bogdan glances up at him and gives him a little nod and a smile. He scrunches his nose for a moment as he looks back at the board. I thought Kaz had run away, maybe home, keep his head down, okay. But Johnny is stupid, not like Tony, and he speaks with his friends and says he shot this guy in the woods and the guy did all the digging, and isn't this funny? And I hear about this. So you go into action, asks Steven. Bogdan nods, and wonders about his bishop and whether Steven might just have something up his sleeve. I tell Johnny I need to speak to him. Don't tell Tony, don't tell the others. I say a friend works in New Haven, at the port, and there might be some money for him, and is he interested? And he's interested, so we meet at the port, about 2 a.m. And there's no security. There's security, but the security man is a cousin of my friend, Steve Georgiou. A good guy. He really does work at the port. Is easier to lie with the truth. So Steve comes along too. Steve knew Kaz. Steve liked Kaz like I did. So we walk across to harbor steps and get in a little boat and Johnny, he is stupid, he just think about money, and we chug, 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 and it's choppy and I'm telling him the plan and we use this boat to smuggle people and Steve's cousin will turn a blind eye and think of all the money. Then I take out a gun and I tell him kneel down, which Johnny thinks is a joke, and I say you killed Kazimir, just so he knows why he's there, so suddenly he thinks it's not joke, and I shoot him. Bogdan finally moves his bishop and it is Steven's turn to scrunch his nose. I take his keys and his cards. We weigh him down with bricks and throw him over, never to be seen. Back we go to New Haven, we say thank you to Steve's cousin, let's not speak of this. Then me and Steve, we drive to Gianni's house, we let ourselves in, we take his passport, we pack suitcase full of clothes, there is piles of money, you know, drugs money, and we take this too, and anything valuable we find. Some of the money is Tony's, like a lot, so I was glad to take it. How much money? Asks Steven. It was like 100 grand. I send 50 grand to Casimir's family. Good lad. The rest I give to Steve. He wanted to open a gym and I thought was good investment. He's a good guy, no nonsense with him. Then I drive Steve to Gatwick, he take flight to Cyprus on Gianni's passport, no one looks. Easy. Then Steve fly straight back to England on his own passport. I call the police, anonymous, but I know enough that they take me serious. I tell them Johnny killed Kaz, and they raid his house. And they find his passport gone and his clothes gone. Exactly. So they check the ports and airports and find he's scarpered off to Cyprus. Steven attacks Bogdan's bishop with a pawn. Just as Bogdan had hoped. And so they check and check for Johnny for a bit in Cyprus, but he's disappeared, and they just leave to Cypriot police in the end. No evidence that Johnny killed anyone, no drug money in his house, so everyone just forget in the end. Just move on. Took your time with Curran though. Always just waiting for the best time. Just planning. I didn't want to get caught, you know. I should think that would be the last thing you'd want, yes, says Steven. Anyway, couple of months ago I installed his surveillance system, the cameras, the alarm system, all of this. And I fitted the whole thing wrong pretty much. Nothing recording. I see.
And I thought, so, now is the time. I can get in house, I got keys made, no one can see me.
Bogdan attacks Steven's pawn, opening up a front that Steven does not want opened up.
Steven nods.
Clever. Just after I did it there's a ring, ring, ring at the door, but I stayed pretty calm, no worry.
Steven nods again and moves a pawn in quiet desperation.
Good for you.
What if they catch you?
Bogdan shrugs.
I don't know. I don't think they will.
Elizabeth will work it out, old boy. If she hasn't already.
I know, but I think she will understand.
I do too, agrees Steven.
But the police would be a different matter.
They are less easy to charm than Elizabeth.
Bogdan nods.
If they catch me, they catch me. But I laid a pretty good false trail, I think.
A false trail? And how did you do that?
Well, when we went to Gianni's house on that night, one of the things we took was a camera, so Bogdan breaks off as they hear a key turn in the door.
Elizabeth back late from something or other.
Bogdan puts a finger to his lips and Steven does the same in response.
She walks in.
Hello, boys. She kisses Bogdan on the cheek and then holds Steven in a tight embrace.
As she does, Bogdan moves his queen and closes his trap.
Checkmate.
Elizabeth lets Steven go and he smiles at the board and at Bogdan.
He reaches out and shakes his hand.
He's a crafty bugger, this one, Elizabeth.
A grade A crafty bugger.
Elizabeth looks down at the board.
Well played, Bogdan.
Thank you, says Bogdan, and starts to set the pieces back up again.
Well, I have quite a story for you both, says Elizabeth.
Can I make you a cup of tea, Bogdan?
Yes, please, says Bogdan.
Milk, 6 sugars.
A coffee for me, love, says Stephen.
If it's not too much trouble.
Elizabeth walks into the kitchen.
She thinks about Penny, surely dead by now.
That was how it ended, in an act of love.
Then she thinks about John, settling down to a final sleep.
He had taken care of Penny, but at what cost?
Is he at peace?
Is he out of his misery?
She thinks of Annie Madeley and everything she has missed.
Everyone has to leave the game.
Once you're in, there is no other door but the exit.
She reaches for Stephen's temazepam, then pauses and puts them back in the cupboard.
Elizabeth walks back to her husband.
She takes his hand in hers and kisses him on the lips.
I think it might be time to cut down on the coffee, Stephen.
All that caffeine.
It can't be good for you.
Quite so, says Stephen.
Whatever you think is for the best.
Stephen and Bogdan begin another game.
Elizabeth turns back to the kitchen and neither man sees her tears.
Chapter 115.
Joyce, sorry I haven't written for a while, it's been very busy around here. But I have a gooseberry crumble on the go and I thought there might be a few things you'd want to know. They buried Penny and John the Tuesday before last. It was quite a quiet one, and it rained, which seemed about right. There were a few old colleagues of Penny's there. In fact, more than you would think, considering. It had been in the papers, Penny and John. They hadn't got the whole story straight, but they were near enough. The news had got wind that Penny was a friend of Ron, too. He was interviewed on Kent Today and they even showed it on the normal news later. Someone came down from the Sun to talk to him, but Ron was having none of that. He told them to park outside Larkin Court and then had them clamped.
Elizabeth wasn't at the funeral.
We haven't discussed it, so that's that, I'm afraid.
I wonder if she had already said her goodbyes?
She must have, mustn't she?
I don't even know if Elizabeth has forgiven Penny.
I'm afraid I take the Old Testament view that what Penny did was right.
That's just me, and it's not something I would say out loud, but I'm glad she did what she did.
I hope Peter Mercer was alive long enough to know what was happening to him.
Elizabeth is a good deal cleverer than me,
and will have thought about it more, but I can't see that she could really blame Penny for what she did.
Would Elizabeth have done the same?
I think so. I think Elizabeth would have got away with it though. But I do think Elizabeth must be sad at the secret. There were the two girls, Elizabeth and Penny, and their mysteries, and all the while Penny was the biggest mystery of all. That must hurt Elizabeth.
Perhaps one day we'll talk about it.
Penny killed Peter Mercer and she kept it from John all her life. Until dementia broke her. And once John knew, he had to protect her. That's love, isn't it? That's what Gary would have done for me.
Because Peter Mercer murdered Annie Madeley, Penny murdered Peter Mercer. Because Penny murdered Peter Mercer, John murdered Ian Ventham.
So it goes, I suppose. And at least now it's done. I wish peace on Penny and John, and I wish peace on poor Annie Madeley. For Peter Mercer, and for everything he caused, I wish nothing but torment.
The police have yet to find Turkish Johnny, by the way, but they're looking.
Chris and Donna have popped over here a couple of times. Chris has a new lady friend, but is being coy about it for now, and we can't get Donna to talk. Chris says they'll catch up with Johnny eventually, but Bogdan was round to fix my power shower the other day and he says Johnny is too smart for that. If you really want my view, Johnny is far too convenient. Johnny came over and killed Tony for informing on him all those years ago. Why would Tony have informed on him? For his part in clearing up a murder that Tony committed? That makes no sense to me. No, the only person too smart to be caught around here is Bogdan. Don't you think he killed Tony Curran?
I do. I'm sure he had a good reason, and I look forward to asking him. But not until he's fitted my new replacement window, because what if he takes offense? I wonder if Elizabeth suspects him too? She certainly hasn't mentioned chasing down Johnny recently, so perhaps she does. I will have to check the crumble in a bit. Shall we get on to more pleasant tidings? Hillcrest is already up and running, there are cranes and diggers up on the hill. They say Gordon Playfair got £4.2 million for his land, and by they I mean Elizabeth, so you can take it as gospel. He said goodbye to the house he'd lived in for 70 years and packed his belongings into a Land Rover and trailer. Then he drove the 400 odd yards down the hill and unpacked it all at a nice two-bed in Larkin Court. Bramley Holdings gave him the flat as part of the deal. Which brings us on to another bit of news. Bramley Holdings. It wasn't about apples, after all. I told you, though, that the name had rung a bell? Well, here's why. When she was very small, Joanna had a little toy elephant, pink with white ears, and she would never let me wash it. I can't imagine the germs it carried, but I think that's not necessarily a bad thing with children. And the name of that elephant? Bramley. I had quite forgotten. She had so many toys and I'm a terrible mother. Perhaps you see where this is going, though. You remember we had taken Ventham's accounts to Joanna, of course, back when Elizabeth wondered if Ian Ventham had murdered Tony Curran. Anyway, Joanna and Cornelius had looked through the accounts for us and they'd reported back, and that was the end of the matter. But for Joanna it hadn't been the end of the matter at all. Not a bit of it. Joanna and Cornelius had liked what they saw in the accounts. And they had liked what they read about Hillcrest. So Joanna had made a presentation to the other board members. This scene, in my head, is around the aeroplane wing table, and then they bought the company. She was planning to buy it from Ian Ventham, but, of course, ended up buying it from Gemma Ventham. So isn't that a turn up? Joanna owns the whole place. Or Joanna's company, but that's the same thing, isn't it? Now, this leads me on to Bernard. And you'll see why. Joanna and I had never talked about Bernard, but she came down to be with me at the funeral, so had Elizabeth told her perhaps? Or did she just know? I think she just knew. So she came down and she held my hand, and in a weaker moment I put my head on her shoulder and that was nice.
After the funeral she told me about Bramley Holdings. I pretended I had known all along, because I felt guilty about forgetting the elephant, but Joanna sees straight through me. But we talked, and I told her I didn't think this was the sort of business they bought, and she agreed, but said it was a sector we have been keen to get into, but I see straight through her too and she admitted that was a lie. She did say there was plenty of money to be made, but she told me she had another reason too. Which I'll tell you now. She sat on the lounger that she bought me, that would have been a tenth the price in IKEA, right beside the laptop she bought me that will never be carried anywhere, and here is what she said. Remember when you moved in here, and I told you it was a mistake? I told you it would be the end of you. Sitting in your chair, surrounded by other people just waiting out their days? I was wrong. It was the beginning of you, Mum. I thought I would never see you happy again after Dad died. We had never talked about this. Both are faults. Your eyes are alive, your laugh is back and it's thanks to Cooper's Chase and to Elizabeth and to Ron and Ibrahim and to Bernard, God rest his soul. And so I bought it, the company, the land, the whole development. And I bought it to say thank you, Mum. Though I know what you're going to say next, and I promise I will also make millions out of it, so don't panic. Well, I wasn't panicking, but that was what I was going to say next. And so a couple of things you will want to know. The Garden of Eternal Rest is staying exactly where it is. Joanna says they'll make quite enough money out of Hillcrest, so the Woodlands has been quietly shelved. The graveyard is now protected, even if Cooper's Chase is sold again, Joanna says they will sell it again one day, that's their job. But just you try and buy it, you'll see there are all sorts of covenants in place. It's going nowhere. By the way, just now, when I said it was both our faults that we hadn't talked about Gary. Of course it wasn't both our faults. It was my fault. Sorry, Joanna. We had a ceremony the other day. Elizabeth invited Matthew Mackey for lunch and along he came, no dog collar this time. We broke the news to him that Maggie was safe and I thought he would cry, but he didn't, he just asked to visit the grave. We walked up the hill with him, then we sat on Bernard and Asima's bench while he pushed open the iron gates and knelt beside the grave. This is when the tears came, as we knew they would when he saw the headstone. I had watched a couple of days ago as Bogdan had spent the best part of the morning gently cleaning up the inscription Margaret Farrell, 1948-1971, before carving underneath, Patrick, 1971. There really is nothing Bogdan can't do. When Father Mackey broke down at this, we sent Ron to hold him and the two of them stayed there quite some while. Elizabeth, Ibrahim, and I stayed on the bench and took in the view. I like it when men cry. Not too much, but this was just right. There are always plenty of flowers on Maggie's grave now. I have added some of my own, and I'm sure you can guess where I got them from. You'll want to know about the bench, too. Well, Busy Bogdan took to the concrete with a pneumatic drill, then dug down until he found the Tiger Tea Caddy, which he gave to me. In Bernard's final letter there was rather a moving postscript, in which he had asked that his ashes be scattered off the pier in Fairhaven. I have it here. Part of me and part of Asima will always be together, right here. But she is floating free in holy waters, so let me drift on the tide until one day I find her again, he had said. Very poetic, Bernard, I'm sure. Too poetic. You and I know Bernard well enough to know that this was sentimental bunk. It was a message to me and it wasn't exactly the Enigma code. I wonder if Bernard might have thought I was a little thick, but I suppose he wanted it spelled out, just in case. Anyway, I knew Bernard had given me my instructions. Sufi and Majid had stayed at an airport hotel after the funeral, because that's their way, and I had offered to keep Bernard's ashes safe until they headed down to Fairhaven. When will these two learn? I had Asima's ashes in the tea caddy and I had Bernard's ashes in a simple wooden urn. I took out my scales. Proper ones,
because I don't trust the electronic ones. I was very careful tipping out the ashes, because, much as I liked Bernard, I didn't want him all over my worktop. Within minutes, and with the help of a couple of intermediary bits of Tupperware, I felt a bit guilty about that, the deed was done. In the Tiger Tea caddy that they had both wanted to buy the other for Christmas was half Bernard and half Asima. The next day we buried the tea caddy back under the bench where it belonged. We asked Matthew Mackey to bless the site and I think he was touched to be asked and did a lovely job. And in the urn, half Asima and half Bernard. And, unbeknownst to them, that's what Sufi and Majid took to Fairhaven the following day, so Asima could finally float free, but still in the embrace of the man she loved. We didn't join them, as we didn't really want to interfere. I honestly don't know what to do with the Tupperware I used. If you've used two Tupperware containers to help mix the ashes of a dear friend and a woman he loved, without letting their children know, is it more disrespectful to keep them, or to throw them away? This is honestly not the sort of thing I had to worry about before I moved to Cooper's Chase. Elizabeth will know what to do. Talking of Elizabeth, she rang me earlier to tell me that someone had slid a very interesting note under her door. She wouldn't say what it was, but she said she'd have to pay someone a little visit and then she could tell me. What a tease. Well, it is Thursday, so I must be on my way. I worried that, after Penny, we might stop meeting, or perhaps it would feel different. But that's not really how things work around here. Life goes on, until it doesn't. The Thursday Murder Club goes on meeting, mysterious notes are pushed under doors and murderers fit replacement windows. Long may it continue. After the meeting I will pop over and see how Gordon Playfair is settling in. Just being a good neighbor, before you ask. And, right on time, there's my crumble. I will let you know how everything goes.